Hey, everybody, Scott here. Welcome back to another episode of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. We are thrilled about this one. But let's talk about some of the sponsors real quick before we get into our episode. One of our sponsors is a woman by the name of Susan Robb out of Toronto, Canada. She lives out her mission to inspire others. Susan is a client partner for the Center for Leadership Studies, original home of situational leadership. CLS is deployed in over 70% of top Fortune 500 companies. Susan is also has a business as a speaker agent. Many of those speakers have been on our show, most recently Sunjay Nath. She can set you up with workshops or public speaking or different arranged speakers to come in and provide you with all sorts of professional development. So contact Susan Robb, R-O-B-B, on LinkedIn. Susan is a great woman that helps us out greatly on this show. Now, one of our sponsors is Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex, New Jersey. Some of the best craft beer around, with 16 rotating taps all the time in their wonderful tap room. They're a perfect room for Halloween skulls and just amazing murals on the wall. This Sunday, they just released Out of Their Gourd, their Acorn Squash Abbey Ale. And then this Sunday coming up, they're going to be releasing a Baltic Porter brewed with Mo Mountain Hot Sauce. That sounds awesome and interesting. So go check out Demented Brewing. Give them some love on the old Facebook and Instagram machine, at Demented Brewing. Joe Fisher from Manskirt. Manskirt Brewing is a brewery located in Hackettstown, New Jersey. It also sponsors the show. They're right in the old bank building there on Main Street. They have big news with Better Than Pants. Their delicious English ale is available in cans this week. Go check out Manskirt. Show them some love on Facebook and Instagram. Now, the third brewery that sponsors this podcast, I was just there at their Oktoberfest, is the Adirondack Brewery, and boy, was it a good time. Go check out some of the videos. They just tapped their Harvest Rye IPA, 7% alcohol, 50 IBU, delicious beer. They brewed with too many whole cone cascade hops to count. It's truly an expression of upstate New York agriculture. All hops for the beer were sourced from local Cold Spring hop farms in Hebron, New York. Bold pine and citrus notes are backed by subtle rye spiciness. Also, Adirondack Brewery next event is on November 4th, and it's Pumpkin Chunkin'. Not sure what to do with those pumpkins rotting on your porch? Bring them up to Lake George and launch them at Targets with a variety of catapults. The whole family's welcome activities include pumpkin catapults, apple slingshots, magician's act, food truck, bounce houses, keg mazes, and of course beer. We went last year. It was a whole lot of fun. Go check out Adirondack Brewing. Now, our newest sponsor of the show, Sleep Ovation. We love working with these guys. Are you waking up with back pain? 50% of Americans are. I know I do. Sleep Ovation's new mattress is 700 tiny little mattresses that individually cradle natural curves of your spine. This provides perfect comfort and spine support for back pain relief and the best damn sleep of your life, man. Pre-order yours now at sleepovation.com. Use the promo code VERBAL and get $100 off your order. It's just really cool mattress technology, guys. You really just got to check it out. Go check them out at sleepovation.com and give them some love on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Finally, Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Trivia Revolution is a trivia company all over New Jersey, and craft beer bars and breweries play trivia each week. I host at Tap House 15 on Wednesdays. Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. All right, so today on the podcast, episode 2 of our Halloween extravaganza. If you tune into the first one, you got to listen to Exorcist Bishop Brian Ouellette. Just a really interesting and deep interview. And today it is no different. We have two really interesting interviews. Now we have one of the interviews. We have Rachel Penman, who works at the Crime Museum. Okay, the Museum of Crime in Alcatraz East, and she's in charge of getting artifacts like O.J. Simpson's Bronco. Okay, really fascinating interview. And if you are a fan of The Walking Dead, T-Dog himself, Iron E. Singleton, joined us on the show in a fantastic interview, and we are very pumped about this episode. So with that, enjoy the podcast. Happy Halloween, y'all.
Hello, everybody. This is Iron E. Singleton, a.k.a. T-Dog from The Walking Dead, and you are listening to The Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun. Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Oops. Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Mike Berlew, seeing you 2 days in a row.
You're welcome.
Let me explain. We're releasing two Halloween episodes this week.
This is our old school days where we'd come into your place like every Tuesday and Thursday kept on recording.
We had nothing else going on.
Mm-hmm.
We had no girlfriends. We didn't really do anything.
Yeah, so pretty much.
But we also had no schedule. We just, like, I don't know, just we're like, okay, let's podcast now. You're bored? Want a podcast?
Mm.
We've got a lot more professional over the couple of years here.
Yeah.
But the reason we did the second Halloween episode is because we had so much material, not even like bits and stuff, but we had three really good guests that spread across these two episodes. So we said, why not release them in two so you're not getting one 3.5-hour episode. You can listen to both of them or split them or do whatever you want. I don't care what you guys do. But listen to them.
Enjoy. That's all that matters.
So I wanted to reflect a little bit. For those of you who are tuning in the first time, me and Mike here, every week we bring on a passionate guest and someone who is unique. We've interviewed drivers and athletes and actors and people attacked by Hippo and you name it.
And Doug Max.
And Lenny Dykstra. There's a lot of unique, passionate people. Each week we kind of interview someone, and we also just like to have a lot of fun here. But last night, if you go back one episode, which was released about 2 days ago, we interviewed Bishop Brian. Let me see if I can say this right. Willette. And Bishop Brian was an exorcist. So really, really intense interview. A lot of information thrown at us. Really in-depth thing on spirits and demons. And
religion.
And religion, yeah. Catholicism and how the Nicolaitan religion is different and what signs of an exorcist. Now, I was kind of reflecting on it today, you know, while at work and driving. I'm like, how do you feel, like, what are your feelings towards, like, the idea of demonic possession and whatnot? Now, I'm not, like, a really religious guy. We've had this conversation before. More like, I think there's this innate thing in us to do, like, good and to build relationships and find positive people and positive things. There's a reason you feel good when you do good things. There's some kind of weird reason you feel bad when you do bad things. Like, that's not learned, I don't think. I think that's something that's in
morality
us.
In the long stream of things.
Right. But I don't really believe in a big man in the sky. Sorry, Bishop Brian. Like, I don't think I do.
He even said God's not a physical thing. Everybody's seen that guy with a large beard and sandals and wearing a toga and just basically saying, I made an aardvark. No, that doesn't happen.
Aardvark.
Yep. That's all God does every day.
One aardvark a day keeps Satan away.
I believed in you all these years just to hear you say this? What the? You're kooky, God.
But the idea of someone being possessed is still a freaky concept, man. It's the idea of, like, you losing your natural state to a possible someone who's died or what he said, energy or some spirits, and you speaking other languages. I guess my question is, do you believe in it? Do you believe that can happen?
I believe it can happen. It's kind of things I sense in life, kind of like people with like Wiccans who have special connections with nature. I can see somebody having, I guess you could say, forces with nature and can do certain things. Now, can I say that everything they do, casts, is going to work, or every person who says there's a possession and they're going to get the spirit out of it? I probably don't see that. I mean, it's kind of weird. Like, if somebody comes up to me and said, hey, I saw a person possessed, yeah, whatever. And it's almost, as funny as it sounds, almost creepy when you see a movie like The Exorcist and somebody says, that's based on something real. And when you kind of look at the movie and like, ooh, that's a creepy thought. And almost when you put more belief into it, then somebody says, no, I was actually a part of this. I mean,
Exorcist still holds up, man. It's still a chilling movie. Like, it's still...
It's incredible.
It still gives you, like, that hair on the back of your neck stand up. Like, ugh. And I don't know if it's because it's a kid being possessed. I think that definitely adds to it. But I think it's just the stoic, like, imagery in that movie, too. Mm-hmm. Like, and just the slow build. It's like, you know, it's not automatically she's, like, possessed. It's like this slow little
signs. They keep on talking about it, and there's rumors, and all of a sudden she's doing a upside-down spider walk down the stairs and stuff like that.
Can you try that for the listeners? Can you try to recreate our Instagram? The front stairs. Leave today to your car.
Right, I'm going to work on some yoga. We'll try it out another night. Not tonight. There's no light up there.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, and what's funny is I don't think he's lying to us. But no. I also don't know if that's someone carrying out an act so far, or like I said, mental. I asked him, like, you know, the first question I was thinking of, and he actually brought it up before. It's like, how do you tell the difference between mental illness and a possession? I'm not sure I believe completely that it's a possession. If not, it's just a different type of mental illness, or the brain almost short circuiting or something like that, and like going through something. But I hearing him talk and being so passionate about what he's done and telling these experiences, it just makes you kind of think. And once again, like I seem to have been my whole life, I kind of sitting on the fence, kind of like, I don't know what I believe. Like, I could talk to one person and be like, that guy sounds really good. And then the complete opposite, I'm like, yeah, you know, that sounds really smart too.
Well, even as we look at a smart level, like when we talked about the Dear David thing, you keep on seeing the pictures and stuff like that, and everything about it, you go like, ooh, this is creepy, and in your head you start believing, but there's also another part of your head like, I'm sure I can explain this and whatever. It's one of those things that you can't really touch, or you're not going to see enough of it where I don't think in either way you're going to fully believe or fully not believe in it.
Right. There are updates on Dear David, by the way.
Oh, you tell.
All right. So those of you who – we'll do this real quick before we get to our guest, which is pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So those of you who are tuning in, if you look up the Dear David story, there's a guy named Adam Ellis. I believe he works for some magazine, online magazine, and he's had this haunted apartment about this kid, David, that he tends to keep seeing. And he's been updating it on Twitter over and over again. But let's see. So last we left off, I think he was leaving on vacation for a while. Maybe he had come back already, but I think in Japan or China, something like that, he was going away. So let's see. I don't want to go.
Oh my God, Dear David's on the line.
I just want to find where this starts. Okay. We can cut this.
Don't cut this. This is the good stuff. People love to hear us struggle.
Okay. So he responded on October 2nd. The past couple weeks have been pretty peaceful. I've had people taking care of the cats, and they say they are doing fine. This morning I went for a long walk around Sapporo. I never really plan my vacations. I just like to wander a lot and see what I find. I came across this statue in a park. I couldn't find out any real information about it online, but it was weird and pretty. So, Burl, if you swing around, you'll see it's like a statue with all these like babies and people holding on to each other and stuff like that. And he says, I was taking pictures of it from different angles since it's cylindrical. I moved around one side and almost dropped my phone at what I saw. Okay, so if you notice, there's a baby here with like a misshapen head, and that's what he was saying that David's been. I felt too similar to be a coincidence. I felt dizzy staring up at it. This kid with a dented head. I don't know, maybe I'm overreacting. Maybe this is nothing. It doesn't feel like nothing. Anyway, I have to pack my flight home in the morning. It'll be good to see the cats again at least. Okay, so he made it home. He's there with the cats. Weird things have been happening with the electricity in my apartment this week. First, two bulbs have burned out in the hallway in less than a week. At this point, I've just left it alone rather than get a ladder again. But the strangest thing has to do with the backlight on my TV. It's an LED strip that plugs into the TV itself via USB. The TV has to be on in order for the backlight to be on, but last night the backlight was flickering on and off by itself. I noticed just some time before dawn when I woke up and went into the kitchen to get some water. I'd barely gotten back into bed again when I saw a faint light come on in the living room. After a few seconds, it went dark again. I went back into the living room and stood there watching the backlight go on and off for at least a few minutes. It was bizarre. Eventually, it stopped, and now the backlight doesn't work at all. It's only a couple of months old, so it shouldn't be dead already. Anyway, I couldn't get back to sleep, so I went to dinner near my apartment. It was the only thing open at 4 a.m. I had eggs over easy, blah, 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 blah. When I got home, the sun was starting to come up, so I figured I might as well shower and go into work early. Showered and brushed my teeth, then head into the bedroom to get dressed. As I passed in the front door, I thought I heard a faint scratching sound from the other side. It was soft, and I wasn't sure that it really happened. I went over to the door, but I was too scared to look through the peephole. I couldn't bring myself to actually put my face that close to the sound, so I opted to take a photo through the peephole instead. Since there's a skylight just outside my door, the hall was awash in a faint yellow-green light, I snapped a couple photos. At first, the pictures didn't seem like anything, just blurry nothingness. All right, so he shows a picture and peephole. But I analyzed it and started noticing things, part of a face, an ear, and eyes staring right back at me. Okay.
I can see the ear in there.
Now, I think maybe it's time to get someone else involved. It's obvious that this isn't going to stop until I do something. I'm just not sure what it is yet. I'll let you know when I figure it out. Okay. For those of you who couldn't make it out, he shows like a picture where he drew the face. It was somewhere. Where he drew, like, what he saw, kind of. Oh, there it is. Okay, so he's seeing, I guess this is what he's seeing here. And it's very similar, I guess, what he's trying, explaining to us is very, very similar to the picture of the statue that he saw.
Wow.
So we might have to put him in touch with Bishop Bryant.
Yeah.
Combine all the worlds here. You big zombie guy?
Nah.
No?
No.
You're not a big zombie guy?
Yeah, I am.
Rob Zombie?
He's all right.
He's all right.
His music is good. His movies are...
Yeah, yeah. Why do you think... I was thinking about this before. Why do you think zombies, or the idea of zombies, has seemed to kind of... It seems like every decade there's some kind of big zombie, like...
Plateau?
Hit thing. Obviously now... The Walking Dead being the number one, but we also had the Z Nation and all sorts of other spinoffs, and movies don't seem to be going away. But why do you think, I guess for as long as movies and cinema has been made, it seems like zombies are kind of, or the idea of the undead seems to be definitely a popular topic and kind of captures the imagination all the time.
Well, I mean, I go back to the Romero films, and he had kind of a social concept with
all
his...
Right?
He died pretty recently, but I think last year. But his movies had, it wasn't just about, you know, zombies. It was about concepts of the world. Like Dawn of the Dead was materialism, and the original one was about wars and social concepts and stuff like that. As for why do people fear them, I guess the way you can look at it is they are the quintessential mindless monster with only one goal and only one care: to tear you apart. There's no negotiating with them. There's no way to get around with them or do anything about it. It's everything that you love in the world is taken away, and they turn into the things that want to kill you.
Okay. Now, like, I know you're a big Walking Dead guy. I was a big Walking Dead guy. But, you know, still watching. Hopefully it picks up a little bit this season. But you said the Romero film. Like, what is it about that gets you about it? Like, I know you're pretty into it, too. Kind of what you said, or is there other things that you...
I mean, I think the item that gets me the most, that I've always got a thing about, like, some form of, like, cannibalism or the coming back to devour people and all. There's
that's
something
what, that's
so,
what you want
to
do?
Yeah, when I grow up, you know. Two more years of college, here I come.
I got this.
But I would say that's one of the more terrifying things, like of another human or undead human devouring or hordes of them and all. It's just that it's something that gets to me. Like, it's nothing that, like, a Dracula film where it gives me heebie-jeebies, but, like, hordes of undead to come back just to feast on you. It's just a kind of a thing that gets into the back of your head, if you will.
All right. Do you think you'd be a good in a zombie apocalypse, in a apocalyptic setting?
I guess it depends on what type of zombies we're talking about. Nowadays, we have two types of zombies. We have the originals we all know, where they're slow moving, and it's more the hordes get you versus a single one. And then kind of in the latest films, like 28 Days Later and the remake of Dawn of the Dead, we had the fast zombies, where I kind of sit back and go, never did work on that cardio.
Yeah, fast zombies are a whole different ball game.
Yeah, I mean, that one right there, that's where I sit back and go, okay, I can understand zombies taking over the world. Like, the one was just, they're just, you know, stifling by, and they really have no motor skills whatsoever. It's like, how did they take over the world? That's something like, there was a lot of people just going, hey, what's going on? You okay? Well, let me go up to them and I'll, hey, you're making weird noises. You okay?
That accent you're doing is almost like a more retarded version of you. Like, if you got zombified and you were kind of drifting into the...
I only got half been. I'm like this, Scott. I'm the co-host.
I think so as this Halloween extravaganza continues to roll on here, as we're in the second day of Halloween broadcasting, I think you're gonna love this one.
All right.
So long ago, when we were setting some show goals, one of the things we set was, you know, a cast member of The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
And we got Sean Lynch. Unfortunately, I forgot I was even talking. His character, they cut him out of the season, but his character continues in the video game, which he says is fine because apparently they're bringing him back for like another game or another edition of the game.
Okay,
apparently, but I think the chances of his footage being in the show are pretty much nixed.
It'd be great if like five seasons from now they're wrapping up the show and they just sneak him in there. Hey guys,
he like looks completely different and aged a little bit. But I was able to, and this kind of came together randomly. I emailed them months and months ago, and I don't think I ever got a response, or maybe I got like an automated kind of thing. But just recently, right before we were scheduling the Halloween stuff, even just this, I don't know, like 4 days ago, I remember texting you. But we have the one and only Iron E. Singleton, who played T-Dog from The Walking Dead.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
So, you're shocked. Oh, man, really? You got to get, like, new, like, a whole bunch. Like, we should make a soundboard, like we did for the Hack Landon, of your different, like, reactions to things. I'll just play one.
Oh,
wow. No way.
Nice.
But, yeah, T-Dog coming on the line, so let's give him a call.
Scott and his buddy Mike are both my buddies. How are you?
Oh.
Hey, Iron E, welcome to Verbal Shenanigans, man. Thanks so much for giving us a few minutes.
Well, thank you for having me on Verbal Shenanigans. I like that. Well,
yeah, I mean, we are, you know, Walking Dead is up there, but Verbal Shenanigans right underneath. Yeah. Right underneath notoriety there.
I would not disagree with you at all.
Irony, thank you so much. You are you're pretty badass because you have two capital letters in your name, both the first and the last letter. That is a feat in itself.
I'm trying to compete with verbal shenanigans. That name right there tops them all. So I'm like, I need to try to match that some kind of way. So I said, ooh, two capital letters in my name.
Scott, you know? Check this out. My middle name is Alan, so I can go by Mike A.
Like Mike A.
Mike A.
See? Oh, so you're getting real fancy on me now, Mike.
That's how I bring it, Iron. I'm sorry. I should have warned you.
But Irony, yeah. Does your name have like a family background to it, or is there reasoning behind it, or is that just kind of how you went on spelling it? How did that come about?
Oh yeah, it's I came with that name. I came up with it about 17 years ago before I went out to LA for a while and in search of, you know, my dream of becoming a big time actor. You know, that's every actor's right. dream. So I needed something to serve as an icebreaker. And at that time, it was revealed to me that I had been through some really dire, tragic situations in my life.
Right.
And that was my testimony needed to be shared. So I came up with Irony to serve as an icebreaker. Irony, which is with a Y, traditionally means that which is not expected. I put the capital E at the end to serve as a pun, because I coined the term irony to mean an eagle in flight with an unbroken spirit. And that capital E stands for an eagle amongst many things. It could be enigmatic, it could be energetic, electrifying, and so on and so forth. So that was my way of breaking the ice with the producers and casting directors out in LA, because I knew that I was put here to share my testimony and not really to be an actor. It was most important that I share my story with others so that they can be inspired and motivated, and to know that whatever they're going through, they can get through it with a bit of perseverance and determination.
I mean, that's way deeper than I thought.
Scott, his name is way cooler than your story, how you got the name Scott. I got to be honest with you. The neighbors, come on now.
But, the neighbors? So let me ask you, I know you we'll get to your one-man show here, but in a little while, but which has a lot to do with some of the things in your life that happened. Now, when you were getting into acting and trying to expose yourself into different parts, where you searching out parts where you could maybe have some of your experiences shine through that character, or you know, where you're able to reveal it, or were you just also trying to do the, you know, I'll act in anything and get into it mm-hmm. first and then kind of figure it out?
Mm-hmm. It was basically, I'll do anything but porn.
Don't sell yourself
see,
short.
I'm the opposite.
Any.
So
what'd you say?
I'm the opposite.
Yeah, he does only porn.
Oh my god! Wow, that's funny. No, it was through my acting experience at my training at the University of Georgia. Go Dogs, Sic'em. We're 7-0 right now, and I went to the national championship.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But yeah, I felt like I could play any role. I felt that I could incorporate who I am into any type of role that I play. Because at the end of the day, it's all about, I guess, incorporating humanity into every role I delve into. So I whether I play a bad guy, a good guy, whatever, it's like, does he have his humanity intact? Like, does he? Because at the end, you know, we're all human beings, and there's this compassion that dwells in all of us. I want to reflect on that to let people know that, hey, I'm as human as the next person. This character is just like you in a sense. You just have different backgrounds, different circumstances. But at the end of the day, we all want to be loved. We all want to be respected. We all want to be understood. And that's what I try to bring to each character. And I figured I could do that to, you know, with any character that I play.
You seem to have such a natural energy just, like, talking to you for a few minutes. And are you always this upbeat when you go into, like, an audition?
Yeah, pretty much. This is me. I learned in speech communications, because I also majored in speech communications, that we have at least two selves. We have our public selves and we have our private selves. So my public self, this is pretty much me all the time in public mode. Now, when I'm exhausted, say when I'm out and about and I'm at a convention or something like that, this is who I am. But that's because I get the energy from the fans and I'm excited to see them. I'm excited to meet them. I understand that my mission is to love everybody I come into contact with, to respect everybody I come into contact with. So I can't help but to be on like a natural high. And then when I get to my room, and I sit on my bed, I just kind of crash because I'm so tired from being so energetic throughout the day. So, yeah.
Now, Arnie, you I'm sure you went through what a lot of successful actors go through, working as janitor number three and football player number four and whatnot. Yeah. But eventually, you have now been in two very, very successful things, and hopefully much more continued. But when you got the role in The Blind Side, tell us a little bit how you got that, how you auditioned for it. Did you have a good feeling knowing you were going to get it, or were you surprised by getting such a main role in the movie?
Both. It's interesting because I booked the role out of Atlanta, and those roles traditionally go to LA actors, but I feel like the role was intended for me. And I would have to apply the adage, what's for you is for you. And nobody can prevent that, because I believe in higher power. I'm faith driven. And I feel like, if it's my time, then it's my time. I thought that I was well prepared through my training at Georgia, my formal training, and also my informal training growing up in that type of an environment. Right. So the character I played, I saw those individuals pretty much every day of my life for 18 years, for 6,570 days. So I knew I was prepared. I was like, yeah, I can, I wouldn't. But because those roles, that type of role, the bad guy, those roles don't really get cast outside of L.A. So mm-hmm. when I got it, I was like, wow, this is, but it's a blessing. So, yeah, so it was both of them. And when I auditioned, I knew I had it. I knew I would knock it out the park, because I was like, I can do this role in my sleep. And I did. And I felt, as I was auditioning, I felt the director and the producer, I felt their energy coming towards me. And I saw them with my peripheral vision. They were smiling. And I was like, oh, I got them now, baby. I got them.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, it definitely worked out for sure. Now, you get this role in The Walking Dead. Everybody knows T-Dog, right? A pretty, a pretty major character in the first couple of seasons. When you got this role, or when you saw these scripts coming up, and before the show was out, did you think the show was going to be as massive and successful as it was? Or did you picture in your mind, like, oh man, a zombie apocalypse thing, like, I don't know, like, this could get campy and kind of, go the other way and be kind of in quote unquote corny? Or did you guys know, like, wow, we got something special on our hands here?
I'm going to have to go with the latter on that one. I had no clue. I don't think anybody had a clue. Everybody I talked to, all of my castmates, we were just thinking we were working on another show. I was not ever really into zombies like that, but although I had watched George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, because my uncle introduced me to it at around the double digit age, maybe 10 or 11 or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I watched a lot of horror movies. My mother took me to watch Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street. I was around 5 years old and six, and she would take me to the movie theater to watch all of this stuff. So I had no interest in horror because I had been traumatized. I was like, yeah, right. I could care less about doing horror. I didn't really give that much of a thought, guys. That was one thing I didn't really give much of a thought to. I was like, I'll do everything from like comedy. I'll do Shakespeare to, drama and comedy and all of that. But I never thought about, I don't think I really gave horror a thought, because I guess I kind of put it out of the back of my mind since I've been traumatized. And then when my agent came to me about auditioning for it, and I was like, oh, zombies. Man. I didn't think about that. But he told me Frank Darabont and Gail Ann Hurd were the producers. So I jumped at the opportunity to work with a couple of legends in it. So I auditioned, and Frank liked it, but he wanted me to do it another way. And so I tried it another way, and I found myself on the set. But my character was supposed to die after the third or fourth episode.
Oh, wow.
In season one. Yes. Huh. But Frank told me during season two, he was like, yeah, you were supposed to die in season one. But he said, man, I cannot find a way to kill you. I just can't see myself killing you. I don't. And I was like, wow, I said, I appreciate it.
Spoiler alert, they did find a way.
Yeah, spoiler alert.
well into season three, though, which was a blessing. I looked at it again like, just another blessing there.
Yeah,
100%. I mean that you feel like decades from now, people are going to go back and watch these early seasons. You know, like get into the show. Kids that have no clue what it's about. I'm like, ooh, what's this? I heard this was successful, and you'll be a legend forever, T-Dog.
That's insane. That's surreal to me, guys. Because, and I think it was Philly, and it was Lori Holden and Scott Wilson, and I were doing our panel, and they referred to us as the OGs. You know what I mean? So that just put a big smile on my face just to be a part of the original group. You know, that says a lot. I'm thankful.
Now, let me ask you, Robert Kirkman, the gentleman who made all the comics, he seems to be really involved with the TV show as well. Is it any different when you have the creator there just like right on base while you're doing the show, kind of leading the way, or is it just another day on the set when you work with him?
It seemed like another day on the set, but just with more laughs, because he's a silly guy, and he has his own brand of humor. And so he brought the laughs, but I wouldn't know what to compare it to, because I don't know of any other project that I've done that was a comic book and converted to a show.
Right.
To a TV show or movie. Yeah. So I wouldn't have any comparisons there.
Now, I'm going to ask you a question. I asked Mike right before we brought you on the show. We were talking about, you know, Mike's really into zombie things and whatnot. And I was talking, and you tapped into a little bit on the Romero side, but the idea of zombies and the zombie apocalypse or the undead has every generation seems to have its movies, its shows, its play, whatever, its comics that keep bringing this kind of back with a new twist or a new take on it. Why do you think like the whole idea of a zombie or the undead really has captured people for generation after generation after generation? What is it about it?
I think I wrote a song called We Are the Walking Dead. And I think the allure is this notion that we are similar to zombies, kind of. Sometimes you see people walking around, and especially more so today than ever, because I don't want to get too deep with this, but I think we all have an understanding that a lot of steroids and the antibiotics and all that stuff we put into our food, and we're taking in a lot of we go beyond moderation. Say, like, we take in a lot of violence on TV through our media and everything. And it's kind of affecting our thinking, affecting our behavior, because I would have to say art is a reflection of reality, as well as reality being a reflection of art. And we take in so much of this stuff, it tends to have an effect on our behavior, like road rage, for instance, kind of control. And you see some people, it seems like they're just kind of floating through life. They're just going through it. They're not totally connected with anything. They seem like zombies in a sense. But the more that of that energy we have out there in the world that's put out there, it affects other people. So it is contagious. So
yeah, I mean, look at the zombies just in like Times Square on their phones, walking into the middle of the street. It's crazy.
Oh man, see, you're hitting right on it there. That's it. That's you, Scott.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah.
Okay, but you're hitting the nail on the head there, and I think that people kind of see ourselves in those zombies, and at times. Sometimes you just, I'm so out of it. I feel like a zombie myself, but we just kind of get distracted, and we get, you know, we're influenced by the stuff we take in our society. And so now we don't just have a few channels that we can watch. You know, when I was coming up, we just had a few channels that we watched, right. ABC, NBC, CBS.
2, 4, 5, 7, 11.
Right. And then, you know, Fox came along later on and all that. But now we have endless channels. We have YouTube, social media craze. So we're constantly getting all this energy. And unfortunately, a lot of it is negative energy because of the sensationalism. That's the stuff that sells, unfortunately. And it's affecting our psyche. And so people end up getting out there and they take that stuff into the world and acting like zombies in a sense. But
it's true. Mm-hmm.
So you were on the show for 3 seasons and you had a hell of a last episode of protecting Carol. I mean, very heroic, just very dramatic scenes and going through the gruesomeness. Kind of give us a sense. How do you find out that they're taking you off? Did they pull you aside and say, hey, we got to tell you something? It's like an HR person comes over and tells you, or do you read the script and you get to page 17 and you start raising your hand? What happens here?
And also, what is death day like? What is the day on the set when you die?
Cool. I did start reading the script from the back. I want to say is this my time? I'm serious. Like every time I got a script, probably starting season one, episode, because I knew my character was supposed to be dead by episode three or four. So episode 4 or 5, I'm looking at my script from the back to see if I'm still in it at the end. I'm like, wow, I got through this. Got to the CDC. I looked and started at the back. Like, wow, I made it through the whole season, all 6 episodes. So that was great. And I did that through season 2. And also, well, going into season 3, I knew because I got the call. So they were really respectful about it. Glenn Mazzara, who was the showrunner at that time, he replaced his buddy Frank Darabont. And he gave me a call. And he told me that my time was about to come to an end. He thanked me for my service, and he told me how wonderful a job I had done. And he said, but you're gonna appreciate the death. And other producers came to me and said the same thing to me. They said, you're gonna really love the way you go out. So I was looking forward during season 3. Before I even received my scripts for season 3, I knew that T-Dog was going to die in episode 3.
Yeah, is that like a badge of honor among the cast, like the deaths, like who's got the cooler? Because if you know you're going, you want to go out with a memorable death, and you definitely had one of them for sure.
Mm, yeah, I'll mix this answer in there, you know, by answering your second question of how is it knowing that I'm going to die and on the set and all that stuff. It is definitely a badge of honor. And I think that Sarah Wayne Callie, she took it to another level because she coined, if my memory serves me correctly, who played Lori on the show, Rick's wife, she coined the term "We Are the Walking Dead," which inspired me to write the song "We Are the Walking Dead." And she gave out these little she gave us necklaces, and she had like these pendants or whatever on there. And it said, "We Are the Walking Dead," season, whichever season it was, season 2, season 3. And then we had what was called the death dinner. So, and Lori and I had our death dinner together because we both died in the same episode.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, so it was really cool. So, you know, we got to reflect on all the good times we had together. And we had the opportunity to just bond and to just love on each other more before we actually left the show. So
that's fantastic.
That was, yeah, really memorable. Really memorable.
Now, Irony, you have one of the reasons we were able to get in touch with you. You have a one-man show coming out called Blindsided by the Walking Dead. And I guess this is kind of big news in 2018. The world tour is going to hit the stages. But what is this about? What are we looking forward to here?
Well, I want to say that in the wake of all of these tragedies, I think that Blindsided by the Walking Dead is more relevant and more needed than ever, given our fires in California, the devastation in Vegas with the shooting, all the hurricanes.
One after the other.
Right? It just keeps. I'm like, what is going on this year? This is crazy. The earthquake, Harvey, Irma, Maria. And so I felt even more compelled to put this show out there. And my heart goes out to everybody. My prayers go out to all the victims of all of these tragedies, some really senseless, man-made tragedies, and then others we just have no control over. But the show is me on stage, an hour, 45 minutes, telling a story through dance and rap and song and comedy, some stand-up comedy. I do drama. It's like 40% comedy, 30% drama, 10% poetry, and 20% song and dance or something like that. But yeah,
no ventriloquism though.
No ventriloquism. And I'm working on it, guys. I'm working on it.
And remember, no porn. We brought that up earlier. No porn.
Oh, yeah,
no porn.
Not that. But,
those are the midnight showings.
If I think about doing that, I know who to call.
Oh, God, please don't. Please don't.
Scott, I got a gig.
Scott, you're in on it, too?
No, man. Just the cameraman.
No, that would contradict the whole show and what the whole show is about. But it tells my life story, growing up destitute in a housing project in the city of Atlanta and overcoming such tremendous odds from running the streets and selling drugs and carrying a pistol and involving myself in violence and losing my mom, being verbally and physically abused at the hands of the person I love the most, my mom, and her being an alcoholic and addicted to drugs, and losing her at the age of 18 from HIV complications. My brother in and out of jail, starting at 14 years old for the last couple of decades plus, and losing so many friends and family members from either senseless violence or HIV. I lost quite a few family members and friends from HIV complications, and then some have gotten their brains blown out. So that's my story. But through God's grace, I end up at the University of Georgia, where I end up playing Division I football. So, you know, the Dogs, we're taking it all the way this year, guys. I think we got I'm the national champion.
What position did you play?
I played DB with the current coach now, Kirby Smart, for 2 years, and then I switched to running back because it was Kirby. It was Champ Bailey who played for Denver.
Wow. Champ was great.
Former the Redskin, yeah.
Yeah, man, we had a bunch of DB. I think that was a huge recruiting class for DBs. So I switched to running back, and I was behind Robert Edwards and Orlandis Gary.
Wow.
And so I graduated from there with a dual degree in theater and speech communications. And I ended up doing little shows, low budget movies, no budget movies in Atlanta Community Theater before I went out to L.A. and then came back. And eventually, once I wrote my show, which it was initially called Irony the Resurrected, then it became Blindside of the Walking Dead after I got my big break. Now, I got my break after writing the show because God was telling me to tell my story for years. I couldn't get an agent for 10 years after graduating from college because I would not listen and obey. But once I decided to tell my story, guys, I got a call a few weeks after that from an agency that said they wanted to represent me. And then a week after that, I was auditioning for The Blind Side, and I booked, and the rest is history. So I tell that story on stage in an hour, 45 minutes, and I am drenched afterwards because it is, it's physically and very emotionally demanding. But I love it because it's affecting the world positively, and it empowers so many people, and it inspires so many.
I mean, just looking at the description, I mean, it literally talks about it's a roller coaster ride, and I'm not surprised by it. I mean, it talks about how you turn yourself into a thug, a drag queen, an Englishman, Richard III. I mean, I almost want to ask you, was it more fun writing it versus performing it? Because this sounds like an actor's dream, what you made here.
But you know, the cool thing about it, I wrote it in just about like a night. Because some of these characters that I play, a lot of these characters I have played in other shows, like like Richard III. I had performed these, and so again, it's my life story, and I'm putting it together. So it wasn't as hard because I didn't start from scratch. You know, I had my experiences to draw from, and so I started typing. And before I knew it, the next day, I had pretty much a complete script. And I let my wife read it, and she was like, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. She said, she'd seen me in several shows. She said, I've seen you in several plays. She said, but this play is the best, and I haven't even seen it performed yet. She said, we have to do this no matter what it takes. So we started. We went into our kids' piggy banks and got their change and coins. We started digging into the couch for quarters and nickels and dimes, and we pawned our car. Other things we pawned, I think we pawned our video camera lens, I think, but to get the money so that we could rent the location to perform the show. So we went for broke. We were already going through it because we had just had a business to fail on us, a costume shop business, and we were lower than low. It couldn't have gotten any worse than that, I feel, unless you're just going back to the projects. I said, that was the worst time of my life outside of the projects because we were struggling so much. And when we did that, then it seemed like everything just started happening after the show.
Now, where is the show going to be performed? It says world tour, so how would people go about looking to where the show is going to be near them, and how could they go about getting tickets and whatnot?
And that is where everybody else comes in, humanity comes in, because it is a Kickstarter campaign.
All right.
And what happened was the other times we performed it in Orlando, Atlanta, New York, New Jersey. And we didn't have the proper funding behind it.
Right.
We were funding it from our pockets, and we didn't have the right promotion behind it. We didn't have the right marketing because we just couldn't afford it. And I started focusing on other things, and I put this show on the back burner. But again, in the wake of all these tragedies, it started pressing on my heart. I'm like, I need to do more. I've got to do more. Like, what else can I do? Because I feel, you know, I'm always thinking, like, how can I make the world better? I got to do something. And my wife is like, the show. We got to do this one-man show. And I'm like, but we can't afford to do it the way we want to do it, to give it justice.
Mm-hmm.
And she suggested a Kickstarter campaign. And we're like, okay, you know what? I meet a lot of people out on the road at these conventions, and they're like, I want to see your show. Well, I've heard good things about this show, because the people that come out, it is a roller coaster ride of emotions. People laugh, people cry, people get sad, people get angry. But at the end of the day, people are inspired. And so they talk about my show, and they're like, I've heard about it. I heard it's great. I've read about it. I want to see it. So we're like, let's take it to the people, and especially the people that want to restore compassion in our society, want to put love back out there, because we have a few more people walking around as The Walking Dead, seems like, and
yeah,
they need healing. So I think people go to bed and they wonder, like, how can I make a contribution, a positive contribution to society? And this is the way to go. This is the route to go if they ever want to do any kind of good in society, is to contribute to this Kickstarter campaign. And knowing my manager, she's going to make sure that every penny is spent in the right place. We already have a team on standby, ready to go, unlike what we, you know, which is what we lacked when we did it in the years prior to.
Right.
So now we are ready to do it the right way. We're asking for the people to make a contribution to it.
So if people want to make a contribution, where should they go? What should they look up?
It's my website, ironysingleton.com. It launches on Thursday in 2 days.
Yep.
But I look at it like this, guys. The contribution is really comparable to what people would get in prizes and gifts, because this is unlike any other Kickstarter, because we're giving out, with the contribution, you may get one of my Irony t-shirts, you get signed autographs, you may even get an autograph with the entire cast from season 2. I've got even bigger gifts, say a Frank Darabont poster that I got when he was there on the show. But we have many giveaways. But my website is ironysingleton.com. And also, I'll be posting things on my social media networks through Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. So as long as they track down either of those, you know, sites on my website, then they'll know exactly how to proceed.
Fantastic, man. I mean, I hope it all works out, and I hope you are in Jersey or New York, and we'd gladly come out and see you. So before you go, I was thinking, so you have this show that covers so many different things, and you're blessed to be on a show like The Walking Dead and Blindsiding. Walking Dead still captures fans every day in these conventions, and you're able to interact with fans and whatnot. How do you feel about it? Is that sometimes overwhelming, or it just comes with today's territory? Like, not everyone gets to experience that. Like, how do you feel about that nightly?
Both of them. It's both overwhelming at times, but I understand it comes with the territory, and I understood early on as a child what my mission was. When I was in the 11th grade, I wrote a paper. There was a contest that was they would have a contest every year, and it was the I Have a Dream contest based on Dr. Martin Luther King's speech, I Have a Dream speech. And I wrote my paper, and on my paper, I wrote, my dream is to become an acclaimed actor on the big screen so that I can motivate and inspire millions of people. Now, my English teacher, she told me that that was far-fetched. And just to paraphrase, because I was from the projects, you know, a lot of people, it was just a blessing to just make it out. It was a blessing to make it out. And so she said, well, you need something that's a little more practical, like acting, that's really not going to happen for you. So choose something that makes sense. And I chose a dentist, and that's just because I met my father two times in my life. And the one time, this is how influential a father is and how impactful a father is in a child's life and how important a father is. He told me to always take care of my teeth. It stood out for some reason. He took me to a family reunion on his side, and he said, always take care of your teeth.
Wow.
And I just remembered that. So from that time, I said, okay, I'll change it from being an actor. I want to be a dentist, which I really didn't want to, but that was something that this man that I knew as my father, he said to me, and it just stuck with me. But in the back of my mind, I knew, like, I was like, no, I'm going to be an actor and I'm going to inspire the world. That was something that God just kind of, we had a mutual decision on that. We came to that mutual decision that is what it would be. So I knew early on that I was going to be an actor and affect the world positively. So right now, if it becomes overwhelming, I shake that off immediately and say, yeah, but and what? I know what the mission is. So I'm going to love them as much as I can. I'm going to respect everybody I come into contact with, because that's part of this job. And it refuels me, too, because when I put love in the world, I get it back. It's like energy being reciprocated.
Right.
So at the end of the day, I feel good. If I put negative energy out in the world, I'll feel a mess later on. I feel bad about doing that. So, yeah.
Go ahead, Mike.
Last question. When you do this one-man tour eventually, and we all look forward to it, are you going to tell us you're not going to go to Georgia Tech to do the show?
No, check this out, though. I do about five to 10 minutes from Georgia Tech. So Georgia Tech is closer to me than Athens, the University of Georgia. My uncle was a fanatic of both Georgia and Georgia Tech. Now, the thing that got, so I grew up watching both. Now, the thing that got me was seeing Herschel Walker run that ball during the Sugar Bowl, I think it was against Pitt in 1980 or 81. I'll tell you my age. I was like 5 or 6 years old. And I was watching it at my aunt's, and I was like, oh, my God, look how he runs that football. And that moment was just, like, etched into my memory. And from that moment on, I always wanted to be a Georgia Bulldog, although I didn't get there right out of high school because my grades were awful. Relatively speaking, I graduated with a 2.8, but believe it or not, I graduated as the scholar athlete at my high school with a 2.8. Right.
All right. And
what'd you say?
I said, all right, 2.8 isn't horrific.
No, I've heard much worse.
But check it out, though, fellas. scholar athlete. Yeah. So I graduated as a scholar athlete, but my SAT score was just awful. So I ended up going to Kentucky State because they promised me a football scholarship, which was not the case when I got there. And they had promised many people. And I heard that was part of their lure. They lure people in by promising them scholarships. So I knew I was transferring to Georgia once I got to Kentucky State and hit the books hard. And I got to Kentucky State. I studied day and night because I had to do a lot of catching up. I was so far behind. I didn't know a lot of things that I should have known. I didn't know about how to even write a basic paper, like introductory paragraph and then you know, like writing a paper. So I had to take a couple of remedial courses, and I finished there with a 3.8 GPA.
There you go. Was,
you know, I appreciate that. And so that ended up getting me into the University of Georgia. It's a lot easier transferring into a university. I'm sure you know that, but than it is to go right out of high school because you got so many kids applying. but having said that, I'm saying that there's a possibility that I will probably do the show at Georgia Tech too. So,
Irony, I wish you the best of luck with this, with the play, and not only that, just but whatever future acting projects you decide to do and whatnot. You're an absolute pleasure to talk to. You can feel the energy coming through the headphones here. Thank you so much for giving us some of your time, and good luck.
Thank you so much, brother. I appreciate that. And I guess that's just my big mouth coming through the air. I'm busting your eardrums, I know. But I appreciate the time. I love you, gentlemen. I wish you all the best, too, and your listeners. I love you guys, and let's love each other. It's free. Hope to meet you one day, too.
So freaking nice.
I know. Man. Like, you, I feel like I could talk to
you. It's almost
hours.
Surprising. I mean, I know they're just people, but sometimes it's almost like, let's hang out.
Well, I mean, isn't that an overarching lesson we've taken from doing so many of these interviews? I can count on maybe one hand of guys that we have been like, oh, that guy seems like a jerk or something. Like, once you get past the initial, like, hey, how you doing? You know, like, people are just people in the end, you know? Like, and everyone's working towards something, whether you're, you know, well-known or not, whether you're Lenny Dykstra or not, you got some kind of goal. You know, Lenny Dykstra's goal is to revolve around scoring the next...
just not with your sister-in-law. Remember that. Yeah.
But what a fantastic interview with Irony Singleton. Awesome. We'll be right back. All right, Berlew. Let's keep this Halloween train rolling. I don't know if there are Halloween trains, but I assume there are.
Something with like a killer clown coming out to ask for tickets or something like
that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But let's keep this thing going. I got in touch with a woman by the name of Rachel Penman. Okay.
That's exciting. Leave it at that.
Yeah, that's it. Actually. Yeah. Just a woman. I picked someone out of the phone book.
Mm-hmm.
No, but she happens to be in charge of, I don't know what the exact term, she's in charge of the artifacts at a museum called the Museum of Crime. Okay. Ooh. Crime Museum. And they got some pretty ridiculous exhibits and stuff like that. So we're going to give her a call and kind of see what goes into that. And so this is Rachel Penman.
All right.
Hello?
Hi, is this Rachel?
Yes, it is.
Rachel, this is Scott Brennan and Mike Berlew here from Verbal Shenanigans. Thanks for giving us a few minutes here.
Sure, no problem.
Rachel, I got in touch with you. I was kind of looking for different things to... We're doing our annual Halloween episode here. We thought, you know, getting someone in that's involved in a crime museum might fit the bill pretty good. So what is your actual title at the museum? I know you have to deal with the artifacts, but what is your title?
My technical title is Director of Artifacts and Exhibits. It's probably what you'd call, you know, most people would just say it's called a curator, but that's my technical title.
Okay. Now, on the homepage, it says the crime museum, is it closed or now Alcatraz East is open? Is that how this is going right now?
So, the crime museum opened back in 2008 in Washington, D.C. And so it was there for about almost 8 years and then closed in September of 2015. A new museum was built in Tennessee, in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. So if you go on the Crime Museum page, sort of think of like the Crime Museum as like the repository for all the historical artifacts.
Okay.
You know, like that's where the knowledge and history of the artifacts are, and where a lot of them are right now is Alcatraz East Crime Museum.
All right. Now, before we get into like what's actually there and whatnot, how did you actually get into this? Were you looking to get into the museum business, or was this an interest that you had that you pursued and kind of fell into the crime museum?
Yeah, a lot of people ask that if I have some sort of law enforcement or like crime background.
Were you a criminal is what we're asking.
Yeah.
No. No, my interest was in history museums, so that's where I'm coming from, the history background. That's what my education is in. And so when the museum opened in D.C., I applied for a job, and the rest is history.
Is there any special treatment with these different articles, considering it's a crime from a crime? Anything that has to be, like, not be touched because we might have a bring up a case again or something like that?
No, nothing like that. Yeah, it would only be... so we have things related to crimes, but then also law enforcement. And then other things from families or that sort of thing. So it's always things after the fact, after cases are closed or done, or things that weren't necessarily directly related to the case anyway.
Right.
Probably the closest example to that would be... this is always a little complicated to explain, but when Natalie Holloway went missing... she was wearing, a particular outfit, obviously, and that's one of the descriptive items law enforcement really wants to know in those critical hours, you know, what they were wearing. Her mom got exact copies from the same store, same brand, everything, of the clothes she was wearing when she went missing, so they would have the exact thing to compare it to if any items or remains or anything like that were found. Those items are now in the museum.
Mm-hmm.
So it's feasible that they could be needed again, but that's really the only item that comes close to anything like that.
Now the Alcatraz East, like, how does it get that name, and do people confuse it completely with Alcatraz, you know, out in San Francisco? Does it have a relation to that, or is it just a name to get attention? Like, what's the meaning behind that?
Well, it goes back to way before the crime museum, even. Probably, I'm not sure, 20-some years ago, our owner, John Morgan, was out in San Francisco and went to tour Alcatraz Penitentiary, and he was like, wow, this is so cool. This is awesome. People love this. Why isn't there a museum that has crime artifacts and talk about the criminal justice system and all of that? So he had this idea and figured out that one didn't exist, and that was sort of the germ of creating the crime museum in D.C. It didn't end up having a connection to Alcatraz then, but when a new museum was being built, it came back to that, really going back to his original inspiration of Alcatraz. And then our location is in East Tennessee, and that identity is very strong to people from there. So that's the combination.
Interesting. So, all right, let's get into some of the things that the museum has, and then we'll also talk about what goes into finding this stuff and some of the stuff that you might be working on, or how you go about getting these things. But you have things, for instance, it says on the website, you have John Wayne Gacy's paint box.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Well, how do... Oh, yeah, no problem. We just have it. how do you go about getting something like that?
Well, we get that question a lot, but for various reasons. I mean, for things like, well, collecting anything, you can't really talk about specifics for a lot of things because of people's privacy and security reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But we really don't collect any differently than the Smithsonian or any other museum. We work with people in the law enforcement community. We work with families and victims' families. We have primary and secondary sources and that sort of thing. So it's a combination of, we get a lot of donations, we have loans, and there's auctions out there. We participate in those sometimes too. But one of the interesting things about this topic is we sometimes talk about, is it America's favorite subject? Because you think, oh, well, that sounds maybe a little bit morbid, but turn your TV on to any channel any night of the week and you're going to see a crime or law enforcement show.
Mm-hmm. Or a whole network, basically.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Discovery ID or anything. Yep. People are all be like, oh, no, that's not my favorite topic. And then excuse me, I have to go watch NCIS.
right.
So when we're looking for those sort of things, you know, a lot of work goes into it, but there's, since this was always such a popular topic, there were collections out there already that wow. people who were already interested in this sort of thing. And so when the museum opened, there were a lot of really great people out there that had already taken an interest in these sort of collections and preserved them before they disappeared. And we were able to work with a lot of those people. So we were lucky in some ways that people had, you know, more foresight before a museum existed.
All right, you have a Volkswagen owned by Ted Bundy. I also
he seemed like a Subaru guy to me. Yeah. I gotta be honest.
Who knew he loved foreign cars?
Yeah,
you know,
he was a psycho.
Yeah. So you when you have these things like something owned by Ted Bundy or something owned by John Wayne Gacy, is there like a when you're setting up the exhibit, is there a certain like a feeling towards it, or like is it chilling to kind of hold or think about, or do you do it just like it, like I don't know, when you're setting up a exhibit, you try to do it very like factual and kind of light, or is it you try to kind of play with the mood of the whole thing, and do you get a lot of people coming just for these type of objects?
Well, I would say that's sort of a I have two answers to that, I guess you'd say.
Cool.
The Ted Bundy Volkswagen, whether you go on our website or social media or emails that I get, is the number one requested, interested in, asked about item in the whole museum.
Really?
Hmm. Far and away. Sometimes it surprises people, sometimes it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And when working with those kind of things, I mean, you know, it's a car. It needs cleaned. You know, we're a museum. We take care of things.
Right.
And so that's my job. And so people naturally ask me a lot, like, isn't that creepy? Or isn't that weird? Or is it weird to, like, you know, when you're sticking your head inside to dust? Maybe I'm just used to it at this point, but it doesn't bother me. It's not like one of those sci-fi shows where like the objects have been taken on a particular powers
that you know of.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Knock on wood, I guess. So I mean that it doesn't bother me in that way. But as far as the exhibiting, we are a history museum. I mean, obviously, we try to make things, use the word entertaining carefully, but like as entertaining as possible for people to learn. If people aren't interested, they aren't going to learn anything. While we do try to keep things, you know, fun where we can in our, like, Wild West section and things like that, and law enforcement, learning about, you know, canines and the horses and things they do, we are a history museum. So everything is about the facts. We aren't about conspiracy theories. We have labels. We use sources. We try to be as correct as possible. And if there is an update, which there is a lot in these sort of things. I mean, we're dealing with a lot of people that are still living. And then we make those updates. Or if there is a mistake or new information comes out that changes things, then we do an update.
Has there been an artifact that the museum has gone after where it was you missed out on? You're just like, damn, that would have been so awesome.
That's a good question. We've been pretty lucky in that department, I guess. I mean, we do have the O.J. Chase Bronco, so, I mean, after that, what else is there?
I was going to say, that's got to be... I'll get to that in a second, but I was going to piggyback Mike's question. Has there ever been an object that you... that someone want to display that you were like, oh, no, like, we're not displaying that here?
Well, I mean, it's We don't go. Sometimes people ask, like, oh, you know, is it gory? Like, is it, you know, gross for kids and that kind of thing? And definitely not. I mean, we aren't going, if it's gross or disgusting, I mean, mm-hmm. we don't display things like that. And even if you think about it, like, we have, there's only two actual murder weapons in the museum,
right?
So it's not really like that.
That's one less than Mike's got in his car.
Yeah. do you need to borrow one? I got some great stories there.
I've got plenty of artifacts you'll need in a couple years.
We have a room with mugshots, real mugshots in them.
Awesome.
That there were all sorts of people that were captured by America's Most Wanted, and there's always people like, oh wow, you know, oh there you are, or I know that guy. But that said, we actually have had corrections officers come through that actually did know some of the people.
Like, oh yeah, he was a good guy. Good guy.
Yeah. I mean, he shipped a lot of people, but still,
always
great
asked,
man.
Always asked about the family around the holiday.
Mm-hmm. But, very pleasant.
All right, let's get to that. Let's get to that OJ Bronco. Mm-hmm. I imagine that's an object that many museums and exhibits were kind of like, I don't know if you bid on them or however it works, but would want, because I feel like that's something I know I would want to see. I think it's just such a piece of, I almost said pop culture, I guess just culture in general, like American culture. And, you know, almost everybody could look at that car and picture where they were when that whole thing
it's
was going
definitely
on.
Definitely pop culture, yeah.
How did you guys get it? And when you got it, did you see a big influx of people coming to see? And OJ's hot right now.
Yeah, he's out. Are you worried that he's going to come out? You saw what happened the last time he found some of his stuff.
Well, we certainly got a lot of jokes and attention recently, but you got to remember that wasn't his car. So sure. What does he care?
Mm. Oh, that was Callan's car.
Yeah, Al Callan. So he didn't own it, so it's not like you've got any claim on it. He was just hitching a ride. People are interested in it when they come, and it gets a lot of attention online. I mean, we definitely got a lot of publicity when his parole hearings were happening, but I wouldn't say that's the sort of, it's not, I don't know for sure, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think it really changes whether people come to the museum or not. It definitely makes more people hear about us. But when it comes right down to, like, going on our website and seeing what we have and the other things we have, it's just part of the complete package.
Right.
And a lot of people still don't believe that it is the Bronco from the chase. They think, like, it's still, like, people are standing right in front of it. And it's funny to watch people sometimes. They're standing there, they're reading the board, and they're like, okay, so this is a replica. And I'm like, where do you see that? Everything says it's real, and it's the real one. It's real. But I think part of that just comes from the fact that it is called, you know, OJ's Bronco, or the, you know, the OJ Bronco. And we even have to do that a little bit because people don't understand that he didn't own it. He did own a Bronco that was identical to this one. But it was taken into evidence because there was blood and DNA found inside of it. And after they were done with it, they returned it to Hertz and they broke it down, sold it for parts. It's gone. And it wasn't the one in the chase, so it's not the one people know anyway.
Now, before we go, like, is there one item for you that... or one exhibit that you think really stands out that people might not even know that you guys have, that you would recommend, or that is your favorite? I mean, you probably maybe not get sick of, but you probably know the museum in and out. But is there something you would recommend to anybody coming to visit the museum?
Oh, that's always hard. I always do have, like, my top 10. I mean, we are known for some of the things like the John Dillinger mask. which is with his, with, you know, his little eyelashes that were pulled out of the mask. So that's,
do you ever put
really
it on,
cool.
You know, like when, no, when the music,
oh,
closes?
No, it's made out of plaster at this point. No. but it was featured in the movie, J. Edgar. So that was cool.
Oh, cool.
And one of the coolest things we have that people really don't realize is we have one of the earliest known law enforcement badges in the country, like from America.
That's cool too.
We have that. That's very cool. That often flies under the radar because it's not very big. And then I guess a little bit more on the creepy side, but I do really find it fascinating is we do have a dental cast. Sort of like almost you get if you're getting braces and they do a dental cast of your teeth, and then they fill it with plaster, and then it's like an exact reproduction of your mouth. Well, they did one of those of Ted Bundy during his case, and that is what ended up, because one of the things that caught him was a bite mark on one of his victims. So they did this, they did this cast to match his teeth to the bite mark. So we have that cast. I often say we have his teeth, but not quite. But they're exactly like his teeth. That's the only way you can see them.
They're kind of like his teeth.
Yeah, so that's just a really interesting forensic story where you can see the, you know, an exact thing that helped put him away.
It's amazing.
Now, being in the background of museums, do you ever get sick and tired of people like us calling you up and just asking you questions about murderers in that sense? Does it get a little old? That answers that question.
No. How am I supposed to answer that? No, I mean, the serial killer gallery is a lot of people's favorite. As far as we've done a lot of study on it, and women love the serial killer gallery. They most often say that that's their favorite. And then men really like the mobster gallery. That's their favorite. Mobsters in Old West. So it's interesting that, that breakdown. But it is important to remember that we aren't just, we aren't a serial killer museum. we start out with pirates. We have Old West. We have Jesse James Holster. That's very cool. Yeah, exactly. We have other stuff. we have stuff that belonged to Bonnie and Clyde.
Wow.
One of her poems that she wrote. And then we do have the whole section on law enforcement and a section honoring law enforcement. We have a database where people can look up, you know, all the members of law enforcement that have been killed by their state, their county, or by a specific name, a big badge display. So we, you know, there's a lot more to the museum than just serial killers, but it is America's favorite subject.
Well, Rachel, I want to thank you for giving us a few minutes on the show. It's, I mean, I would love to visit, but if people do want to check you out or check out what we're talking about and maybe plan a trip, where should they go?
Yeah, I mean, we've been, definitely been a destination visit since we moved to Tennessee. So we're in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, right outside the, or sort of in the Great Smoky Mountains, right on the Parkway. So come check us out.
Awesome. And do you love your job? Like, do you, is it something that changes all the time, or is it something that's challenging and you're always looking for new things? Or do you, is it kind of like cushy, like the museum set, don't got to do much anymore besides talk to podcasts?
Well, since we are a museum, we always have rotating exhibits that are temporary, and we usually change at least two every year.
Cool.
Not to mention, we're always acquiring new artifacts. There'll be a lot more, you know, going out next year. We have temporary exhibit that just opened in September on scams and fraud awareness that we did with AARP. And so there's always things changing. There's always new things to collect. You never know what's going to land in your email tomorrow morning. And And whenever that happens, then there's like a lot of research that goes into figuring out, is it real, is it not, do we want it, does it fit with the museum, because not everything does, but there's no 2 days are the same, that's for sure.
That's great. Rachel, thank you so much, and good luck with the museum, and thanks for giving us your time.
Appreciate it, Rachel.
No problem. Thank you so much.
If they want to bring Night of Museum to like a dark turn,
I know.
You go right there. Ben Stiller and all, Charles Manson, what are you doing here?
I was thinking like the same thing. I'd be like, that's a good setting for a movie. but yeah, I mean, I always find like working at a museum is probably a cool job. I think like something that's like where you're in charge of like research and like looking, searching out things. It's like what we do. Like we email people to try to get them on the show, but they probably like email and go crazy, like just like looking for artifacts. It's like treasure hunting.
Yeah, I think it's fun for the people who are like into it, but there has to be like some security guards like, stop asking me questions about that. I'm just here to make sure you don't touch the damn Bronco, okay?
Halloween.
Yep, pretty much.
Brings a lot of...
Yep, thanks for listening, everybody. Halloween. Yep.
Brings a lot of spiritual things.
Mm.
Hauntings from beyond.
Are you talking about, like, spiritual, like, vodka or something like that?
No. I'm talking about spookiness and scary things.
This is, sounds like the Smooth Jazz Halloween episode.
Oh, turn your dials to Spook Radio.
TJ 101.9.
But I got a special edition of...
What?
Oh! A Halloween version!
Oh, man.
That's right, Burlo.
When they dress up like tigers now?
Yeah. All right, Mike Burlo, it's a special all Halloween edition of Bear News.
Oh!
We have upped the game, all the stories of bears. It's been a couple, it's been a while since we did Bear News.
Easily. Feels like 4 months minimum.
Jeez. But Bear News is back. Ladies and gentlemen, we're tuning in for the first time. Bear News is a segment that is exactly what it sounds like. The why, I don't really know why. I just happen to like bears. It's kind of taking a life on its own.
Mm-hmm.
But Bear News, we go through bear stories. This happens to be very Halloween themed. Burlo, the bears haunting Dracula's castle in Romania. Bears haunting Dracula's castle.
So if Dracula bites a bear, do they get double fangs?
I don't know, but getting to Romania's Poneri Castle isn't easy.
Okay.
First, there's the drive to a rural part of the country around 100 miles northwest of Bucharest.
I gotta think most of it is rural areas when you talk Romania.
Yeah. Then there are steps, 1,480 of them to be exact, to the top of a steep hill near the Fagaris Mountains. And now authorities say there are also bears to contend with. The castle was built in the 13th century, but made famous a couple years later by its notorious occupant, Vlad the Impaler, also known as Vlad Dracula. Right? The castle has since become a popular tourist destination, and that popularity brings food and garbage, which Romanian police blame for attracting bears. One in particular, likely a mother protecting her clubs.
You get away from my clubs!
A mother protecting her cubs has recently forced the closing of the site, according to BBC, following tense encounters with visitors. Authorities are now trying to find a way to relocate the animal family somewhere without such popular legend attached to it.
See, this sounds like a bitching level to Castlevania. It's like, whoo, I made it through the yard. Oh, shit, bears! Oh, damn, this is a good game.
Yeah, I just picture like two, like 3-bit bears, like, you know, like, boop, boop, boop. Like you have to crawl, like jump onto different platforms to get over them and not get seen by them.
Shoot your cross, Simon Belmont.
So that is Dracula's castle has bears, Mike, as if it wasn't haunted enough. All right.
Hey, I bet there's a bear there.
What was that sound you just made? That was very primal. I don't that's definitely going onto a soundboard. All right. So there's a hotel called the Tacoma Hotel.
Okay.
Okay.
It's like a legend. It has a lot of like paranormal activity and stuff like that. Now, this one, there's a story of Jack the Bear. Jack the Bear, okay?
All right.
The Tacoma Hotel's most famous resident was an 800-pound brown bear named Jack.
Okay.
The hotel, built in 1884 and designed by famous New York architect Stanford White, was a luxurious destination for the wealthiest of Tacoma's visitors, and it also served as Jack's favorite drinking spot.
Okay.
Jack, raised by people since he was a cub, was renowned for not spilling a drop of drinks he was given. He was a big fan of beer and cosmopolitans and would stagger around the hotel's bar and billiards room, mesmerizing visitors and locals alike in the 1880s. Jack Spann overlooked Commencement Bay and had an easily subvertible fence. Tacoma residents were not surprised to turn the corner of a street and see Jack touring the streets of downtown Tacoma after a long day of drinking. Jack was beloved by all and became a main tourist attraction at the Tacoma Hotel. One night after slipping his collar and getting out of his pen, Jack startled a policeman. The policeman was not familiar with Jack or his harmless demeanor and shot the bear twice in the side on Pacific Avenue. Jack was carried back to Tacoma Hotel by friends and doctors but could not be saved. Jack was then stuffed and placed on the wall of the hotel, greeting guests outside the dining room for years.
You think that cop got yelled at? No. Bro! Jack the Bear! You didn't read the manual?
Dude, it's Jack!
Oh! Dude! Oh, I guess all bears look alike, huh? Typical cop.
I love this loaded bear just stumbling around the hotel. Feeding it cosmos.
Somebody's in the honeymoon suite like, get... Jack, you're drunk. Get out. Jack, get out.
Let me have some.
No, you had too many cosmopolitans, Jack. Get out of here.
Jack, not again.
Bro, I put a sock on the knob. You know what that means.
So, yeah, the loaded bear. I'm the loaded bear.
And then he was loaded with metal.
Yeah. So this one goes back to December 9th. September 14th, 1915.
Wow.
We're going to go to Sankibetsu, Japan.
Why wouldn't we? Okay.
And not the Japan you're thinking of with all its baffling video games and sexual perversions. Back in 1915, the vast majority of Japan was made up of sleepy little farming communities.
Ooh.
Think Oklahoma, but less relentlessly awful. Japan had maintained a long-standing tradition of getting everything backward, even the Goldilocks story. One morning in November, an 800-pound Usuri brown bear wandered up to the Akita family homestead in the Sino village of Sankibetsu Rokusensawa. The bear fled only after only a few minutes, but returned several days later to a nearby house and mauled a baby before dragging its babysitter off into the woods to be eaten.
Ooh.
Move over, former saddest thing ever. There's a new chief in town. A hunting party chased down the bear and managed to shoot it once, but it escaped. The general consensus among the group was, good enough. The next night, the bear made its way to another house and killed three more people. This time, 50 local guardsmen made it to the house in time to fight the bear. If you ever watched a monster movie, you know how this ended. The Sankibetsu murder bear escaped yet again into the night. We'll say this for the bear, he didn't like to waste meat. Upon their return to the Oda house, a search party found what was left of the victims, a head and some leggy bits buried in the snow for safekeeping. In 2 days, the bear catastrophe robbed six people, one of whom was pregnant, of their lives. The local militia was so terrified that they began to flee their posts. Only the men who had survived the recent war of Russia had the balls to stay. Local authorities soon realized they had one option. Call up Yamamoto Haikichi, an expert bear hunter with a legendary reputation. Unfortunately, Yamamoto had pawned his gun for several days earlier. He refused to request on the grounds that he would much rather be drinking. Eventually, the town managed to convince Yamamoto to come and save their asses. He helped form a squadron of anti-bear snipers. Even with 60 men and a cadre of elite bear hunters on the trail, it took several days to hunt down and finish off the bear. The autopsy revealed traces of his victims in 836-pound carcass.
There's so many things going on in this story.
Break it down.
Let me try to break it down here. First off, this is the most... This bear is more gangster than Jack the Bear.
I love him.
Yeah, I mean, he took like six bullets and he's like, screw it, man. I'm still killing.
I love him.
Yeah, man. He kept
going. He's inspirational.
Number two, how are you, if you're a masterful bear hunter, how's it like, no, I got a drink. No, I... You don't sound like the masterful bear hunter. I mean, you talk about Japanese traditions and all that. Third off, how did they have to specify that the snipers were anti-bear? Like, did they do a survey? All right, you want to come on it? No, I'm pretty pro-bear. Sorry.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, just because they shoot bears doesn't mean that they hate them.
Yeah, it's... You know, they have different political opinions. They respect the bears, but at the end of the day, they have a job to do.
Right.
I got it. All right.
You know. So, I mean, Jack and this bear, pretty legit.
But it's going to be hard to beat Dracula Bear. It's going to be very hard. I mean, maybe you drag it out during sunlight, and that's how you kill it. But
yeah. All right, I got one more that kind of leads into a creepy story here.
All right.
All right. Have you ever heard of Edward the Haunted Teddy Bear?
Can't say I have.
All right. Annabelle and Chucky are both creepy as hell on a good day. Mm-hmm. But real-life haunted teddy bear Edward is equal parts darling as sin and terrifying. Manufactured in England in the 1990s, Edward was supposedly sewn by a woman mourning the recent death of a child. Her hands trembled and tears flowed as she put the stuffed bear together, and this sorrow is said to have instilled the bear with a dark malevolence. Okay. All right. So there's a little video that goes along with it. I'm going to play some of the audio here.
Yeah, bring it to me.
All right. So let me just sit up here. So you ever have any toys that creep you out?
Any toys that creep me out?
Or like, no, I don't like dolls. I know that's common. I mean, I don't like dolls.
We kind of talked about it before. My mom had an antique doll that's really creepy. I wanted to get her to do a photo. Unfortunately, they're down in Florida now, so we're going to have to wait for it.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they'll be like, it's gone.
Or maybe it'll be on your like doorstep. All right, so let's hear a little bit about Edward.
Meet Edward. His story was sent to us anonymously.
Ooh.
Mm.
He is a Merrythorpe bear dating from the 1990s and was handmade at a factory in England. His story is said to begin with a machinist at the factory who had recently lost a child. Every day she went to work with tears in her eyes, heartbroken, yet determined to provide for the two children she had left.
I guess she had no PTO.
However, her stitches were steady and straight no more. Her hand shook each time she used the sewing machine. Edward the Bear was the result of her tears. He was branded a poor quality second, not suitable to be sold in the
You've
shop.
You've been branded that before.
Poor quality second.
A worker at the factory took Edward home for his four-year-old daughter. Her name was Emily. Emily and Edward developed a strong bond.
But then...
When Emily would speak to Edward in the other room, her father would claim to hear another voice whisper back. Objects mysteriously moved from one end of the room to the other. There was no one present, except for Edward. However, the most terrifying part of the story was how the father stated that he was haunted by the same reoccurring nightmare. He would witness his daughter dying, with the teddy bear always right next to her, his beady black eyes staring at the father. Eventually, the father could stand to live with the bear no longer. He could not shake from his mind the bereaved machinist, and how her tears had seemed to have given some sort of dark life force to Edward. It was at this point that Edward was given to a family friend who had an interest in the paranormal. He made a promise to the father to keep the bear safely away from Emily and other children. He stayed with him for many years. When he passed away, his son took possession of Edward. He was determined
this bear away
to solve
already.
The mystery
yeah, really.
Of this enigmatic bear once and for all. This footage was captured 2 years ago by the son at his home in England. When he submitted this video to us, He warned that some who have watched Edward have experienced physical effects, including headaches and even heart palpitations. One lady, who claims to possess the gift of mediumship, even alleged to have dreamt of the bear for many nights after seeing the footage.
You're going to dream about this bear, Berlu.
Ooh.
Not the normal bears you dream about.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Many minutes into the recording, the camera appears to capture the bear moving of its own accord.
Well, bear just moved and kind of looked at the camera.
What is going on in this video? Does Edward the Bear harbor a dark secret which links back to his grieving creator? Share your thoughts in the comments below.
What do you think, bro?
If you enjoyed this...
Crock of crap or what?
It's creepy. I mean, looking at the bear, it doesn't seem like a design from the 1915
era. It looks really, really, like, neat, too. Like, yeah, it's not beat up.
Looks like 80s kind of... teddy bear, you know, that kind of a new age attitude, but
now how are 80s teddy bears different than 50s or 70s teddy bears?
Well, you know, they have various characteristics, such as their love for Madonna.
The bears love Madonna.
Yeah. I mean, that's when that bear moved, they were doing the seance with the song Like a Virgin. So,
oh,
that's what happened.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm off tonight. Just going to say.
So, which bear are you more impressed with? Jack the bear, the murder bear, Kasagaki the murder bear, the teddy bear, or Dracula bear?
I would hang out with Jack the Bear because he's awesome.
Yeah. We'd love to have Jack the Bear like roaming around here.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be a great podcast. I guess I would have to fear the murder bear since it is a murder bear.
Right.
I mean,
it's pretty badass though.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool where the Dracula bears are at, but in the end, I would probably be like, this is part of the tour.
The Dracula Bears does have a video game level feeling.
Yeah, it. Like Super Nintendo. It's like, oh shit, they brought it up a notch. They're flying.
Yeah, I like my favorite story is Jack the Bear just getting loaded in the lobby. Mm. But that is the Halloween edition of
Bear News.
All right. Two really, really interesting guests tonight. One obviously very well known, but I just
shove it in the other guest's face.
Yeah, you unknown woman. No.
Hashtag me too.
I think I could work for a museum. I know Alex worked for a museum for a little bit. I don't know exactly. I don't remember what she did exactly, but she definitely worked for a museum. It's pretty cool. I don't know. Would you feel weird holding like John Wayne Gacy's like paint button where he painted his face for him, and you know he murdered children after that?
I mean, I'd probably stare at it for a little bit, like, this is the thing.
What about like John Dillon just mad? Could you put it on your face? Would you put it on your face? Be like, I'm John Dillinger, bang, bang.
If nobody was around, I wouldn't be surprised. Babe brought something from home, from work.
What is it? What the? But, pretty awesome to hear, man.
Yeah, really.
So let's, before we get out of here, I know we got one more thing, and then we wrap up Halloween 2017, which has been a lot of fun, though.
Yeah, let's get to work on 2018, the way these shows are going.
All right, well, we've got Christmas episode to work on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, go ahead.
What's going on?
Huh?
I'm really confused.
Are you actually confused?
Yeah, what are you, Am I promoting something?
No, I thought you said you had something.
Oh, okay. What was it? I'm looking at you. All right, go. I'm like, what?
Well, I don't know. I thought you knew. I thought you knew. All right. Go ahead.
All right. The well planning of verbal shenanigans. All right, I got a few news story headlines, if you will, we want to go over.
Yes.
A universal flu shot may be nearing reality. Did you hear about this?
No.
Yeah. After years of searching, scientists believe they have finally have better strategies to attack the parts of the virus that stay the same from year to year, offering the hope of protection across multiple seasons.
All right. I don't get the flu shot. I never get it.
I got it like once or twice, but it was the same results of not doing it, so yeah. I never get it. Yeah. Scientists believe they can prevent tens of thousands of deaths in the United States. They also believe that tens of thousands of people who hate their job will now have to come up with a better bullshit excuse to call out of work.
Yeah, we have the flu shot at work. They offer it every year. Like refill. I'm like, nope, I'm not putting it in my body. Don't let my body fight it. If I get it, I get it. Like I've done 11 years in a germ-infested, you know, building. I think I'm okay. Like I haven't gotten it.
And that's what you do in your spare time. It's very weird.
Knock on wood. But
all right, going out, babe.
You going back in that building?
You know I love that place.
All right, headline two.
All right, Snickers. Are you a candy bar fan?
Not really. I try not to eat a lot of chocolate. My weakness, as far as like anything sweet, is when I actually do crack into ice cream, I can't stop. Like the Ben and Jerry's thing, I can't eat half of it. Mm-hmm. I can't. I'll be like, there's one more. And then before I know it, oh, I'm like, there's only one quarter left. So
I can't just put a quarter back.
I'm just going to put a quarter like back in the fridge. So I might as well eat it. And then I feel gross and I feel like really sick afterwards. And I'm like, I feel fat and disgusting. And I sit on the couch miserably. And then we get ice cream again like 2 days later. And the cycle kind of repeats itself. But I'm not a big dessert, chocolate kind of guy.
Well, Snickers is going to have three new flavor options next summer. As part of Snickers Hunger Bar Collection, that's the one where they have the cute sayings on the bars, like satisfies and whatever.
Okay, yeah, I've seen that.
The new flavors will include fiery, espresso, and salty and sweet.
Okay.
Mars is excited for the new candies for all candy lovers to embrace. They want to apologize for the fact that they still make bounty bars, though.
Bounty bars.
Yeah, that's their rendition of mounds.
Rendition of mounds. All right.
Forbes just released their top 40 wealthiest sports team owners. You want to take a crack at any of them? Who do you think is on there, team-wise?
Who do you think? Jerry Jones is up there somewhere.
He's not in the top 10.
All right. I would think the owner from Manchester City is up there.
They do not list them on here. Damn. They do have no.
Nope.
Stanley Kroenke of the Los Angeles Rams and Arsenal, worth $8.1 billion, is five.
Wow. The Rams. And I did know he owned both of them, but I didn't think he... Yeah, I guess the Arsenal is London.
Yeah, the top five is Mickey Arison, $9.4 billion. He's the Miami Heat. Philip Anschutz, $12.6 billion, owns the Kings and the Galaxy. Paul Allen, $20.6 billion, owns the Seahawks and the Trailblazers. And Steve Ballmer, $33.6 million. He's a part of Microsoft, and he owns the Los Angeles Clippers.
And he's the richest, huh?
$33.6 billion.
The Clippers.
Yeah.
I figured he could buy a championship at that point. But
the list was considered, though, a little flaw, though, when somebody put the owner of the Cleveland Browns on the list, thinking that they were a sports team.
Mm. Yeah.
He was actually 25th. One other one. Europe's biggest annual folk music concert, Night of the Tartana. That just wrapped up in Italy this week, Scott.
The Night of Tartana?
Yeah.
All right.
It's the 4.5 hours of music and dance event that attracts top international stars and drew some 200,000 fans to the event this year. The theme of the event is the Tarantella. A lively folk dance and musical style originated in southern Italy, with a dance that derives its name from the poisonous bite of a local spider.
Oh, like tarantula.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Europeans love the event as it's considered Italian's version of Woodstock. Americans hate it because this sounds like the weak-ass backstory to the fifth reboot of the Spider-Man story.
we just tried watching that last night, and we have the Fire Stick, and we watched the first 50 minutes, and we're like, all right, we're in, and then it just was like, it sucks. So we're going to watch it eventually, but...
The Homecoming one you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yep, that was good.
Yeah,
was
I heard good. It was good. It looked like it was good, but... All right.
Those are my headlines.
All right. Berlew headlines, something we're going to try to do a little bit more.
Yeah.
Maybe if you send them to me, I'll try to write a punch or two. We'll see. Mm-hmm. I got enough things. But Berlew, anything to promote? Let's go home. You can go home.
Yeah. I'm going to do our friend Dominic Bagnato. He just put out a book, Making Your First Feature Film, Lessons I Learned the Hard Way. It's on Amazon.com. Just look it up for him. He's a good friend of the show. He's been on the guest a couple times, along with his lovely wife, Kim Boyko.
She's promote her also. Yeah. Kim Boyko is a very good singer. She's she's gotten like 5,000 subscribers on YouTube. Her songs are like, she's doing very well on YouTube. So look up Kim Boyko. Berlew, I'm going to promote you to go along with the guest that we had on tonight. I feel it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So in a week or so, you'll be promoting tonight on The Walking Dead. So why not promote,
Michael Berlew Random Stuff is the name in the page.
Michael Berlew Random Stuff. And I'm sure you'll be blasting on some Irony Singleton podcast.
No doubt.
But guys, life is funny. Laugh at it. I hope you enjoyed this Halloween extravaganza. Keep the wind at your back. Goodbye.
Ooh.
Carl.